Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. This is a special podcast or a special edition podcast looking at equity valuation and especially sensitivity to interest rates, something that we could be very high on the agenda for equity traders next year if yields begin to rise and inflation pushes higher. With me today is Peter Garnery, of course, our head of FX, head of FX, head of equity strategy. That would be me, the FX guy, down the line. And Peter, these are largely your slides, and I'm here to maybe take a little bit of the expertise out of some of the things you're saying once in a while to make sure we're communicating to as many listeners as possible. I think the more advanced folks out there will be following along with everything you're saying. But let's dive into this. What is it that sort of prompted our idea to do a whole podcast, a special edition podcast about equity valuations, and especially what is this interest rate sensitivity? What has it meant in 2020? As we've seen some crazy success stories in equity markets, especially in among U.S. Mega caps.
Exactly. So if we start a little bit in the helicopter and go back in history, we're talking about interest rate sensitivity is basically what is called duration. So duration is a concept that is used throughout all fixed income. And it's a measure that measures the sensitivity to a 1 percentage point change in the interest rate to the underlying bonds. And for the 10-year benchmark index in the US for treasuries, you're typically looking at a duration of 7 to 8, which means that if the interest rates go up by 1 percentage point, your underlying bond portfolio holding this benchmark index will go down by 7 to 8% roughly. So that's the measure. And that measure became very popular and was conceptualized 20 years ago. And there was a lot of attempts to do it in equities as well, because if you had a coherent risk management framework where you had a duration profile in both equities and bonds, you could slice and dice your portfolio to such extent that you always knew, or you could neutralize even your interest rate sensitivity. So if interest rates moved up 1% or down 1%, you could sort of neutralize and construct a portfolio where you would be rather immune to that. So there was a lot of appeal to this. Then the concept waxed and waned over time, and it was difficult to grasp it. And I'll show that in a couple of slides very shortly. But talk about duration and interest rate sensitivity have really, sparked renewed interest during 2020, because as you can see on slide 2, our first chart, you had that dramatic drop in equities, but very quickly you had a supercharged bull market broadly, but more specifically in what you and I, John, have for months this year, or I mean more than half a year, have talked about on our podcasts and quick takes and presentations. These long duration assets, they benefit from low interest rates. That's what we have been talking about so much. So that's high growth stocks, where a lot of the cash flow and the present value of those cash flows are fined to the future.
And what this, and just to cut in there, so what this means is, and there's been this talk of some stocks trading as a bond-like proxy. That sounds very boring in some ways, but it means actually very spectacular returns, doesn't it, for any company that has both stable profits and growing profits. Just it's like it's almost like having a bond with a growing coupon. Yeah. And we've seen one of the poster child stocks out there that I've brought up a few times. It's not the only one, but it's Adobe. So a company, software company that has spectacular margins because it doesn't produce anything physical. It sells into a monopoly market, has a monopoly in a lot of the areas it operates on. It's just able to grow that 20% every single year, and then operates on these valuations that are on multiples that are just beyond anything that was conceivable in prior market regimes. And that is because of this duration you're talking about, meaning that its cash flows, because they're stable and because they operate like a bond proxy, you can get a valuation almost like it is a bond.
Exactly. And we'll talk more about Adobe and Microsoft as an example of these bond proxies, because it's not only about the interest rates, as you suggest, it's also about the stability of your earnings, but not only the stability of the growth rate, but also the stability of the earnings margin, or the profit margin. But we'll get back to that. So it renewed this discussion about duration or interest rate sensitivity as a concept, because it seemed very logically that if interest rates were this was below 1% in the US, it even went to 0.5%, then surely your alternative was so bad that why not just take a lot of risk and buy the most highest expectation growth and disruptive technology you could get your hands on? Because why not? I mean, everything else was just priced to nothing. So take super risk on future and betting basically on the world not drowning into the abyss on COVID-19. And that paid out pretty well. And that's why we have the discussion today. I would say with slide two, and then we can quickly move forward in the slides, is that it's very difficult, and you know this as well, John. You probably operate in one of the most, if not the most efficient market in the entire world, the currency market. And it is super difficult. It's almost impossible. I think it is impossible to narrow down cause and effect relationships or changes or what's going on in the market to a single factor. It's just impossible. And I'm showing that on slide two, basically, by saying that a lot of the rebound we have seen in equities can mostly be explained by the rebound in the discounted value of expected dividends over the next 10 years. So a key thing long-term for equities is obviously always the earnings growth. And that, before we move on, John, is important to note as well. So when you discount cash flows from companies from the future back into today, it's not only the interest rates which drives the discount rate, it's also the future growth of those cash flows. And there is a link between the interest rate and the growth rate, because if interest rates are very low, you know that very well, John, you're pretty astute in macro, it means that there's a very low growth expectation baked into the market, because if its growth expectations were high, you would also have a high inflationary picture, and then interest rates should be higher, right?
Sure.
So there's this link, and that's potentially why also the relationship's a little bit more stable than what you would suggest.
All right, and that leads you into the really important question here, and that's from what I think your next few slides are. That is this key question around the relationship between yields and bond prices, safe haven treasuries, especially, of course, and the returns, total returns on equities. And we've seen some very big regime changes and shifts and patterns that don't always line up across different eras of market history. So take us through those next three slides, and then we can talk after that about what some concerns are for portfolio construction if correlations move into positive territory.
Yeah, I think this has tremendous and interesting links to risk parity and portfolio construction. But if we start with slide three, you can see the long-term picture between in the US. That's where we have the best data. So from 1974 to 2020, so that's a lot of years, basically. And what we are showing here is that on the x-axis, you have the total return index on treasury bonds in the US. On the y-axis, you have total return index on US equities. So when bond prices go up, interest rates go down. So what you're seeing here is a slight positive relationship in changes in those two total return indices, meaning that when bond prices rise, you also see rising equities. So when interest rates fall, you have seen a positive relationship to rising equities. That has been the long-term relationship. But as you can also see from the red line, and I'm not showing you any of the statistics from this regression, but it's a very negligible relationship here. It's almost
flat line. The line regression is almost flat. So it's basically saying it's a bit weak.
Yeah, to say the least.
A bit of a weak correlation at best.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what have happened over time, and this is what is also the whole jinx of this discussion, is that then we moved to a period like 1990 to 2000, which was basically the high growth economic decade in recent time, at least in the US and the global economy. I think this is where we got the most out of the initial phase of the globalization. You had the initial low hanging fruits of the technology and software breakthroughs. It created a lot of optimism as well in equity market, the .com bubble at the end of this period. And you can see here the slope sort of increased and became more positive through this period. So you had a more distinct relationship that falling interest rates came with higher interest rates, and that correlation means that the correlation between bonds and equities were positive. But then fast forward, if you go to the next slide, John, 2005 to 2020, this is where a lot of the risk parity portfolios and asset allocation models have been doing extremely well and have been so successful. We have some of these asset allocation models from BlackRock on our own Saxo Select investment universe on the Saxo trading platforms as well. The relationship suddenly flipped to being negative. So whenever you had rising bond prices, so falling interest rates, it was actually coupled with falling equities. So suddenly you had the opposite correlation where bonds and equities were moving opposite each other, and that created better risk diversification and better risk-adjusted returns in balanced portfolios. And I think we have talked about this, John, before, also in the podcast with Steen, that we're probably getting to a point where we have maximized and or maxed out on this risk diversification between equities and bonds. And with these low interest rates, I mean, you have to ask yourself, okay, can I really construct a portfolio on these principles over the past 20 years in the next 20 years, or do I need to put in other things in that portfolio?
And the key question being for those risk parity models and the idea behind risk parity, it's a bit more complicated than did you simply have bonds that offset your equity risk. You have to like leverage up that bond portfolio or that bond allocation in order to get the right volatility adjustment relative to your equity volatility. But you would have to have interest rates basically going to minus 100 basis points to have a chance to, for example, for 10 years, to have the chance for those treasuries to offset your or the bonds to offset your equity risk. That's the chief point, that we're at some sort of near at least some sort of absolute zero for the bond portion.
Exactly, and also we're touching on some of the concepts here of the dangers of quants, because I just wrote a pretty lengthy piece. It's a 15-minute read yesterday, where I talk about all the trends in equities and what to expect for next year. And one of the things that happened here in 2020 was also the disillusion and the uncertainty over quant principles and quant strategies. I mean, you have some of the most sophisticated, super smart people, PhDs in astrophysics and physicists and mathematicians, etc., at Renaissance Technologies and Two Sigma, etc. And they obviously operate some very successful funds with very short-term pricing signals that have done well this year. But they have funds as well that are open for the public, which use longer-term signals where you have, fewer amount of data points to do your modeling. And it comes back to this discussion, John, that we've seen a structural break this year. A lot of the relationship that these models were based on the past 20, 25 years broke down this year. I mean, Renaissance Technologies equity fund is down 20%. Two Sigma has also, similar negative returns, et cetera. And these are smart people. So something happened in 2020. And I think it's worth considering whether you can construct and view the world through the same lens, and I don't think you can. I mean, this is a little bit of a warning signal to don't base too much of your assumptions on the past when there's a big regime shift and it's happening.
And it's a classic, in a smaller, more simple example of that was the U.S. housing prices into the housing bubble, where quants were looking at the history of housing prices and saying that house prices have simply never fallen in nominal terms, so therefore it can't happen. And of course, that was a silly assumption being put into those models, when that proved false because they had ramped up to an unstable degree, driven by financialization and CDOs and all that nonsense.
Yeah. Before we go to some examples and some other charts, important to understand this concept. Slide six. It's just it's a smaller period, so don't put too much emphasis on the actual regression, but it's the period from October 2018 to 2020. So it's from the peak in the US interest rates at around 3% more or less on that late October 2018 all the way down. And here the relationship is pretty clear. It's so because of that decline we had during the COVID-19 fallout, you had basically bond prices rising and you had equities falling. So that there you had sort of the opposite relationship that we are talking about. So that's where we are. But I think to understand the the interest rate sensitivity and equity duration, we need to couple it with some examples, but also to get an idea of what it is. Because I think the overall conclusion, and if you look at slide 7, I've actually put in a quote from Bob Litterman, the guy behind the Litterman portfolio approach, and he works for Goldman Sachs Asset Management, and he had a pretty good piece out on equity duration, and one of the things that he talks about is that there's this. So first of all, it's a very difficult concept to get right, but then secondly, so it's difficult to get right in a sense to apply it on the broad equity market. So the next question, John, is that can we use and understand the interest rate sensitivity for a more specific part of the equity market, namely the technology part of the equity market? Because if that's the case, if there's a link there, then it's important for next year. Because if you're right at Saxo and interest rates go higher next year, then potentially that part of the market could be at risk, and that's important for U.S. equities and a lot of investors out there.
And that's illustrated with your chart on the Microsoft free cash flow yield. Precisely what we're talking about is becoming almost a bond-like instrument, the Microsoft stock, and declining to that because the stock price is rising relative to its actual underlying profits. So the free cash flow yield is dipping down close to 3%. I can't remember. You had a number at one point saying if interest rates rose by X, the 10-year rose by X, then that would mean a X tens of billions of dollar hit to Microsoft's market cap, assuming that their free cash flow yield would have to adjust to a similar degree.
Yeah, it's actually on slide 8, and it's Steen. Steen have used this in some of his presentation. I've used it, of course, myself. But this really goes to show how sensitive actually valuation becomes when you move very closer to zero. So Microsoft, as you say, is around 3%, and 3%. The 3% threshold on slide 8 is the exact, I would say, threshold before things go crazy. so let's just
because of the multiples, because when you go down to 1, the 3 to 1, it's the tripling from 1 to 3 or a doubling from 1 to 3, etc.
Exactly, it's just going bonanza basically, and it's difficult when you don't have any free cash flow. So then you have to use the future cash flows. But some of the stocks that we've seen lately with, Snowflake and DoorDash, et cetera. I mean, with Microsoft, you have actual free cash flow. You don't have that with the other companies, but you're seeing multiples that are 100 times the revenue. So you're getting an idea. If you could use the free cash flow, but you could use a future cash flow, you would be very high on this curve on slide 8. And that gives you an idea of why you're seeing these explosive valuations. But also Tesla, to some extent, is very far high on this curve. So if we talk about Microsoft, we had 3%. So what could the craziest thing that could happen and supercharge this this bull market in equities and maybe take it ultimately into a very dangerous bubble is if the Fed decides next year that we're not going to allow the interest rates to move significantly higher. We'll cap the yields as we did around Second World War and the period after that. If that happens, then they will drive real rates deep into negative territories, and then I think everything goes in equities. I can't even comprehend what could actually happen. And you talked about it, John, in this podcast, right? That the market is potentially trying to show the Fed and the other central banks with the crazy price action in Bitcoin and silver and everything else. That I mean, if you go down this road, I mean, everything will go. Answer basically.
Yeah, that's such a critical point. And there's 2 points here. A, given these aggressive readjustments in valuation and multiples, I mean, look at that Microsoft cash flow yield. That was, how on earth did it get to 14-15%? At any point, the assumption there had to be that eventually Microsoft was going to stop growing or something. Regardless of that, the key takeaway is A, I mean, a laser focus on long yields is absolutely critical, because these valuations become highly challenged and the market volatility picks up if yields are allowed to grow higher, the yield curve steepens, et cetera. I mean, we saw back in the end of 2018, as you pointed out, when the 10-year rates hit above 3%, then, that essentially broke the world.
Yeah.
The world was falling apart in terms of the U.S. equity market was lurching into, pretty much an outright crash. what turned it around? The Fed changed its a message, and this is well before COVID, and was already starting to expand its balance sheet well before COVID as well. So watch the yields. Are they allowed to go higher? If they're not allowed to go higher and they're capped, then as I guess the other assumption has to be, though, in that environment of higher inflation that you're still seeing, though, and you emphasized this earlier in these slides, you still have to see that the companies are making money. And I guess that could be a bit of a challenge for some of them, at least in a more inflationary environment in terms of wages or inputs into their business.
Exactly. Before we talk about Adobe and maybe go full circle on Microsoft and some other technology companies and the interesting comparison between US and Europe, I just want to go quickly back to slide 7 and talk about that quote from Bob Litterman. I've highlighted in red with bold type font here that the assumption is that the interest rate sensitivity is actually higher for growth stocks. And that's also the conversation we have just had. I think that's true, but you need another component, and we'll get to that in slide 9. But what he says here is that basically actually that according to their calculations at Goldman Sachs Asset Management, they actually see that there's empirical evidence that the duration of growth stocks is actually lower than value stocks or stocks that are in the tangible world, because growth stocks can more easily adjust and to changes in inflation, whereas tangible business are more is basically a prison to that environment, to an inflationary environment, because they have physical assets. It's much easier to reallocate your resources if you're a digital company and you're not hit as hard. And I would actually argue that if we take this quote at face value, then thinking about next year and we get high interest rates, what could that mean? Well, it could simply mean it doesn't necessarily need to translate into a crash in technology stocks. It could be, but it could also be that they just are flat or slightly down, but nothing to really to worry about. And you get a super bull market in value stocks, because think about it. Value stocks are miners, is energy companies, is financials. And financials like high interest rates. They like a steeper yield curve. And that's currently what we are sort of looking at trajectory-wise. Energy and industrial and mining companies thrive, I think, on high interest rates, because they are so coupled to economic growth. High economic growth drives demand for physical assets. So that could be the outcome next year, that the interest rate sensitivity on the growth stocks are maybe not in the neighborhood 1 to 2%, but you need to go beyond 2% or closer to 3% before we really get see the hammer, basically, as you talked about back in 2018.
With the wild card being the balance of the strength, actual strength of the growth, and the degree to which rising yields are a product of MMT, fiscal forcing, money printing, et cetera, that I can think that would be a key caveat. And then again, like we just mentioned, the wild card being how the central bank deals with that rise and whether they actually move to cap rates.
So many moving parts.
There are many moving parts, indeed. And then on the opposite side of that would be the deflation, disinflation scenario, if yields actually begin to drop. And that I would assume would probably coincide with lower profitability. And that's, of course, an entirely different reason for stocks to go down. But and you've got actually a little bit, that's a bit further down the presentation on credit spreads. I think that's a key point to make as well. But before that, you're looking at something else. You're comparing geographies here, Europe versus the US.
Exactly. I'm calling it the European paradox in the context of interest rate sensitivity, because some of the arguments, and I've had these discussions as well with the clients of ours, and that is that, okay, so if there is a positive interest rate sensitivity into equities, Peter, why haven't we seen the response in European equities to the same degree as US equities? Because rightly so, I mean, interest rates have been even negative here in Europe, if our logic is right and the world could be reduced to such a binary relationship, then obviously European equities should be, you know, staging a monster rally, but they haven't. And I think, and this is my hypothesis, I think the missing piece here is that in order to supercharge equity prices on lower interest rates, you need to have earning stability and stability in your growth. And that's the whole case with Adobe. Adobe went from what you said, John, the old software sales on premise business model where you sell a piece of software and it's a one-time fee, and then if something goes wrong or they want an update, they can come back later, the customers, and buy an upgrade. But at Adobe said, to hell with that business model, we're moving to a subscription model. It's much better. It worked splendidly for magazines in the old days, and let's do that for software. And the multiples just flipped on a dime, and Adobe, I think, has been one of the best stocks in the past 10 years. And it's driven by this earning stability. And I think it's so key because think about it. This is the whole very concept of a fixed income instrument is that it's fixed. It's known. So the variance of your future cash flows have almost zero variance unless there is a default risk. And that risk is very small in probability terms for most securities.
I just wanted to break in there. Just as another example of that, I just was astounded by the, if you look at Disney, so the Disney Corporation, and all of its physical assets out there and amusement parks, and even these, it was ginning up some crazy cruise liners. But it was this, I think this recent price launch. I think it's, you see anywhere where you're seeing a company moving into something resembling a subscription model, you see these valuation flips. And I'm wondering if that's what happening with Disney, people realizing if Disney can get X number of subscribers and it's able to have pricing power and raise that monthly subscription rate. And that's why maybe the Disney price exploded.
Yeah, it's the whole Disney Plus, and so I definitely agree, and we've seen it in so many places, and so I looked at the European and the US equity market on slide 9 on what's called a earnings per share R squared. So basically, it looks at how easy it is to predict next quarter or next year's earnings per share based on the previous year. So if there's a perfect linear relationship, you can get a very high R squared ratio. In other words, that your past trend is extrapolating into the future. In other words, you know, as an investor, if I buy Facebook, well, I'll get 22% earnings growth next year, and then I'll get 20% the following year. So it's pretty easy to do my models. And what you find, and when you find out, when you look at across all the 600 equities in Europe and the 500 in the S&P 500, is that you get this chart to the right where you can see the area. The blue area is the S&P 500, and the red is the stock 600. And the y-axis is measuring frequency. So what it really means is that the blue area is much larger on to the far end of the chart, meaning that there is a much higher frequency of companies in the S&P 500 with very high R squared, in other words, very high earning stability, whereas that's not really prevalent in the European equity market. And what that means is that, and this is exactly driven by the very near nature of a high degree of technology companies, subscription-based technology companies, and the US, and that's probably one of the biggest successes of the US economy, I think.
Non-cyclical companies versus
non-cyclical, exactly.
Volkswagen, which is having physical deliveries and the ups and downs of economic growth.
Exactly. So basically, if you're buying the S&P 500, you're getting less exposure to the cyclical parts of the economy. You get higher earning stability, and as you can see on the chart to the left-hand side, there is a very clear valuation premium for higher earning stability. And so the more stable your earnings are, the higher the valuation premium is on a forward basis. So I think this is the missing piece. And that's why we have seen the interest rate sensitivity work better in US equities. And why I say that it's a fickle concept if you look at broader equity markets, but if you narrow it down to technology where you have stronger networks effects and you have this higher degree of earning stability, then suddenly I think this concept of equity duration crystallizes itself in a more natural way, and I think it gets supercharged even more. So one thing is the earning stability, but then also if you have a high growth rate in a low macro growth environment, then it becomes even more crazy. So that's what you actually see here on slide 10. I'm showing the Nasdaq 100. So that's the technology index in the US capturing biotechnology companies and semiconductors and software companies, and earnings are up 800% since 2003. And then I have on the green line, S&P 500 earnings are up a little bit more than 100%. It looks like 140 on this chart. And then Europe have basically had zero earnings growth for 17 years. And I think this I think this trend just reinforces the expectations and the narrative that you're basically stupid if you're not buying technology companies, because they're the only ones that are growing in a low growth environment. And then if you have low interest rates, why not just price the hell out of them? And so I don't care about whether the valuations are sky high. So I think these are all the pieces that link together, converges to an explosive equity market in technologies.
And to be the devil's advocate, though, there's so much focus on how the elite six or seven companies, however many it is, that have been seen the vast majority of that earnings growth, or at least a very, very large portion of it, the FANGs or FANG, however many letters you want to add to that,
plus,
Facebook,
exactly.
Amazon, Apple, et cetera. The risk then to this divergence for it to continue, at least to the scale it has so far, would be antitrust moves. And I think that is actually a big risk that is almost a galloping one that we're seeing, at least in the news phase of things, and actual moves, and at least in the U.S. Congress, even from the EU side. So there has to be a caveat, and we're describing this, but there has to be a caveat that that these companies are going to be allowed to operate as they have in the past. And I think that there's going to be more and more dark clouds gathering over that ability from the antitrust side. I mean, regulatory authorities are so slow to catch up with how these monopoly companies have taken over various bits and pieces of the economy. So
they we've talked about it endlessly on our podcast, I think there's a lot of signs that this technology regulation is coming and it's galloping with very fast pace. I think the signal from China as well is that I think the governments are increasingly getting frightened over the power on information that these companies have. I mean, if you think about it, in the old world where the physical world was the most dominant part, I think the governments had a pretty good grasp, had the upper hand on power structures. They controlled, infrastructure. So if you think about it, ports, railroads, highways, etc., are the natural glue in a physical world, whereas in the digital world, it's information, and the governments are not controlling the information flow. It's basically dominated by maybe maximum 10 companies in the world that sits on the majority of the information and knowledge. And they are excellent gatekeepers of that and extract a lot of profit from that. And I think it's inevitable that we'll get a lot of regulation. And just a final point, because not everyone that will listen to this podcast are a regular listener of our podcast, but we recently talked about a concept that I was not aware of until recently, that the Justice Department in the US back in 1965 actually struck a deal with AT&T, which was the big telecommunication company at the time in the US. I still think they're big, but they controlled or had the biggest private research laboratory in the world called Bell Labs, where you have had the most Nobel Prize laureates coming from that lab. And the part of that settlement with the Justice Department in 1965 was that every single technology should be opened up to the world royalty free. That was part of the settlement. Mm-hmm. And the arguments are that you had the technology on the transistors and the C operating language, all these the programming language, all these things that were key ingredients and components in the future digital world came from Bell Labs, and Apple and all the future companies, Microsoft, they didn't have to pay a single dime royalties to Bell Labs. So the whole idea is that, and that's what the technology community is fearing, but maybe they shouldn't, but basically that one day Facebook and Google and Microsoft will be told to open up their technology. Maybe not royalty free again, but maybe at a very low cost, so we can get another wave of innovation. Because you cannot have innovation if a few companies are controlling all the key patents and technologies.
Yeah, and then there's also the one of the reasons they've gotten away with a lot of things is the principle that developed that a monopoly is not a monopoly as long as there is no consumer harm. And there may be a lot of consumers that are enjoying a lot of these services. Hey, they're free, but they're not realizing what the cost of their privacy is, etc. But is it doing damage to the overall economy in terms of productivity losses from monopoly behavior, and in terms of the other participants in this? And that is other companies, small companies, entrepreneurs, et cetera. And that'll be, I think, part of how that shakes out. But we're getting maybe a bit of mission creep in terms of our presentation here. Let's go to your last slide and talk about the importance. And it's always important. It's in the past been something that's sort of often, at least in my experience and looking through market histories, flagged when you have a risk, an increasing risk of a market correction in the broader equity market when credit starts to clearly tighten. You're seeing credit strains.
Yeah, you actually very clearly see the concept, or not the concept, but the crash we had. And policy mistake in late 2018, when I think it was in December, just around the Christmas holiday period, when the Fed said, "Nah, we're just keeping interest rates steady," or they communicated that they didn't see any signs of constraints in the economy and financial markets from high interest rates, and then we got the big crash, and then they reversed in an epic U-turn in early 2019, and you saw the run up to that epic change in equity valuations. You can see that on the on slide 11 on the green line, which is the global aggregate credit yield to worst. So you had rising credit yields, which were combination of improving economic fundamentals, but also a rising yields in the US forced by the Fed that was constantly rising the short end of the yield curve, and that pushed up the entire yield curve. And then suddenly you can see the blue line, it snapped and the free cash flow yield spiked, I think almost 130 basis points in something around 6 months. As you can see on this chart, that's a pretty dramatic change in an otherwise calm environment relative to the 2011 period, where you had a big change in the free cash flow yield, but that was because of the euro crisis and the potential dangers of a totally disintegration of Europe.
Right.
But what I want to show with this chart, John, is basically just the narrow relationship and the narrower relationship that we have seen lately. So from around the peak there, or from the crash, sorry, in late 2018 until today, you see a very tight correlation between the changes in the in credit yields and the free cash flow yield of the Nasdaq 100.
And it's policymakers essentially putting the backstop behind the economy during the COVID-19 crisis, essentially saying back in the spring, look, we're not going to allow anything to fail. This is nobody's fault. Everything needs to be sort of frozen in place until we get to the other side of this. And I think there's going to be a big risk on the other side of this, because a lot of companies have taken advantage of extremely generous credit conditions to even further leverage up their balance sheets. So if we get into a situation where we're seeing okay growth in the economy heating up, you might see higher rates. And then are these companies that are maybe not so good companies in many cases able to roll their debts. And I wonder if the credit spreads could be an advanced indicator one day, despite what you're showing here, which is the extremely tight lock in those correlations. I mean, the policymakers can provide all the liquidity in the world, but at some point, does solvency mean anything? I mean, are we going to go into a totally Sovietized economy where nothing's allowed to be priced? There's no price discovery in anything anymore. So I think that'll be very
like
interesting.
A world I want to live in.
No, well, it's kind of the one we're in right now, but let's see how things shape up. Hopefully when we're getting post COVID-19 in the space of the next quarter or two.
I'll just end this podcast, John, by saying that I think it's absolutely key to follow the credit yields next year because of that tight relationship we have seen over the past 2 years. So watch that and watch generally the change in interest rates and inflation and the whole how the physical world maybe is pushing back on the digital world's demand. And not that we're going to promote Goldman Sachs all the time in this podcast, but we have, and I like the research. I read other banks' research as well, but I just found this quote from Goldman and that's probably a good way to end this, is that with bond yields closer to zero, equities appear more attractive than ever, but higher absolute valuations boosted by tech growth stocks have made equities more risky. And I think that is exactly where we are right now, that in theory they look attractive, but the valuations, as we talked about in this morning's podcast, John, it's pricing in a perfect rebound over the next 2 years. So not a lot of things, if they go wrong, needs to go wrong before things can change very dramatically to the downside, I think, for equities. So that's your worry, and that's why you should be maybe apply a little bit more risk management.
And that could be why the VIX seems to have been reset at a doubling of its former range, at least its former range low. It seems to be 20, seems to be sort of an absolute zero now versus something like 10 before. So that's an interesting side comment to that. And there is certainly a lot more volatility than there was in some of these prior market run-ups. Yeah, well, this has been a great podcast, a good long conversation. I hope you, the listeners out there, found it useful. Thanks so much for all of your time, Peter. And if you have any follow-up comments, questions, or otherwise, possibly some that we can address on our normal daily market calls, feel free to contact us on Saxo Market Call. Sorry, I get this wrong every time. marketcall@saxobank.com. That's marketcall@saxobank.com. Put that in the top of our slide deck as well, so you can see that address. For now, have a great holidays out there, and we'll be back next week with our usual daily Saxo Market Calls. Thanks for joining.